Good morning and welcome to the Tuesday edition of The Morning Show. I'm one of your hosts, Phil Huff. In the studio with me is also our co-host, Julie.
Good morning, Phil.
Good morning, Julie. How are you?
I'm great. How have you been?
I'm wonderful. And today is a day to celebrate. You can't see this on radio, but here we are in the studios dancing because it's October 2nd.
Yes. And we have a dancer in the studio, someone who dances to The Morning Show every week, we've just heard.
So we've got a pretty packed show this morning. We're going to talk all about what happened 50 years ago on October 2nd, 1968, and we'll get to that in a moment. First, we'll go through a little bit of the weather. Everybody's looking outside going, okay, now the rains have finally arrived.
And I'm happy.
Yeah? Yeah. Why is that?
Because I put down weed and feed.
Well, I thought you meant it was going to put some more water into the streams and maybe activate the trout a little bit.
True. Just a little weed and feed, by the way. I don't like to do it, but I had to this year.
Well, today it says 80% chance of rain, but it sprinkled a bit on the way in and the pavement's wet, so I'd say it's happened.
Yes.
High today of 56 degrees. Tonight, showers likely. A low of 38. So we're getting down close to where it might be frosty sometime this week. Tomorrow, mostly sunny, a high of 54, low of 33. So in certain areas, that does mean there'll be frost.
That's true. And I must mention one other thing about the rain, Phil. It's good for mushrooms. So for those of us who are mushroomers, things could start happening.
Yes. Well, we like the rain too. It tamps down the last of the fire from the seasons, kind of sets everything up for winter.
It sure does.
Skiers are looking hopefully up at Schweitzer to see if it translates into any dusting on the tops of the mountains. It
would be fun to see that.
So let's get to the show. We've got three guests in the studio with us to help us celebrate October 2nd, 1968. 50 years ago today, President Johnson signed into law four major pieces of legislation. We'll touch on that in a moment. But the National Trails Act, the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act, and some stuff that protected some wilderness areas and parks. And we're going to look at the policy implications of that, the work that continues on, and reflect on some personal experiences. So we have with us Brad Smith, who's the North Idaho Director for Idaho Conservation League. Good morning, Brad.
Good morning, Phil.
And Shelby Herber, from also from Idaho Conservation League Community Conservation Associate. Morning.
Thanks. Morning, Phil. Morning, Julie.
And newly joined the organization. Happy to have you here in Sandpoint.
Thanks so much. Happy to be here.
Very good.
And Deb Hunsaker, who in the case of full disclosure, I know very well. She's my wife. And together we have hiked a lot of trails, dear. Tell us a little bit about your hiking resume.
Well, I have hiked the Triple Crown, which is the Appalachian Trail, which we hiked in 1997, Pacific Crest Trail, which we thru-hiked in 2004, and the Continental Divide Trail, which we did over three summers.
And a little bit of the highlights of the paddling experience you've had on some, certainly wild rivers, even if they're not quite in the system entirely.
We paddled the Yukon River, which was 10 weeks on the water, 2,000 miles. And then we've done some other trips on some rivers in southern Utah.
Neat.
Yeah. So we're going to hear a little bit about other personal experiences. Again, I'd like to set up the show a little bit by just reflecting on what this date means for all of us. And again, in October 2nd, 1968, President Johnson signed into law the National Trails Act. It established the Appalachian Trail and Pacific Crest Trail as the two first national scenic trails, but it also set up a process to study 14 other trails for inclusion. To date, there's 11 total. On the same day, he signed the National Wild and Scenic Rivers Act, which gave that status to eight rivers. It's been used multiple times since then to include other rivers and streams, totaling over 200 unique sections of stream and about 12,000 miles. Some iconic ones right here in Idaho. We're going to hear from Brad Smith about that. And on the same day, he signed the law that conserved a large chunk of land in Washington State as the North Cascades National Park, expanded the Glacier Peaks Wilderness Area, and created the Pasayton Wilderness. And he wasn't done. A fourth bill was signed right alongside the others that created the Redwoods National Park in California. Broad sweeping legislation. Quite a day.
Amazing when you think about it. Probably not repeated since, or I would guess we won't see it again in our lives.
The magnitude of those bills, just really huge. And its implications for both recreation and conservation are tremendous. And so with that, I'd like to turn a little bit of this over to Brad to talk in general about the huge implications for conservation.
Yeah, October 2nd, 1968 was a really important day for conservation in the United States. As Phil mentioned, you know, major pieces of legislation were signed into law, creating, you know, some designated national parks and wilderness areas in Washington State, the Wild and Scenic Rivers System, the National Scenic Trails System, and a few other things. And it was quite a bundle of legislation.
Say so.
Yeah. And, you know, to me, the really interesting thing weren't just the immediate impacts, but the tools that it gave for us all to use for future work in that area. And reflect a little on that, Brad.
Yeah. So, you know, I think probably one of the notable ones was the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act. This was a point in our nation's history when there were lots of large dams being built all over the country by the Army Corps of Engineers and the Bureau of Reclamation. Those two agencies were engaged in a little bit of competition, I guess you could say, between each other about who could build the most dams, even though some of those dams maybe weren't wise decisions. But it really galvanized some conservationists around the country to kind of take action. And, you know, Idaho is really interesting in this when it comes to this issue because Idaho was actually the birthplace of the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act. We have some pretty interesting history here, right here in our state that led to the passage of this act. It was proposals for major dams on the Clearwater River, the Salmon River, and the Snake River that really led to the drafting and passage of this act. Those dams that were proposed on the Clearwater, the Salmon, and the Snake Rivers would have effectively eliminated Idaho's salmon and steelhead runs. And it really galvanized conservationists and sportsmen to push Idaho Senator Frank Church to do something. The original concept was to create what was called a salmon sanctuary, and there was a bill drafted by Senator Church to designate the Salmon River as a salmon sanctuary. Congress didn't really have the appetite for something like that, so they actually decided, well, let's make a national Wild and Scenic Rivers system instead of just looking at just the Salmon River. So they drafted this piece of legislation that had not only implications for Idaho, but the nation as a whole. And with that legislation, several rivers were automatically added to the Wild and Scenic Rivers system, including the Middle Fork of the Salmon River in Idaho, the Selway, and the Lockaw River. And the purpose was to preserve these rivers in their free-flowing condition.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, Frank Church had an integral role in the original legislation as well. He was right front and center.
Yep, he sponsored the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act and led the charge to pass it.
And, you know, in your initial introduction of Frank Church into this discussion, you said he was pushed by environmentalists, but he was pretty environmental himself. That guy was, wouldn't you agree? Or did it take pushing? Did he learn? How did he come into the, how did he enter into this mix?
It definitely took constituents in Idaho to push him to get this to happen. You know, I think if you reflect on Frank Church and his history as a senator, you know, he was actually pretty moderate. While leading the charge to pass the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act, he was also a supporter of Dworshak Dam, which did cut off a salmon run on the North Fork of the Clearwater River. So, you know, I think he really took his cues from his constituents and what they wanted. And if it hadn't been for sportsmen and conservationists who wanted to protect the salmon runs in Idaho, we probably wouldn't have the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act.
And so the remarkable thing, too, was the vision to not only work on Idaho, but to create a system that had national implications. And the connection here that you've described for salmon in Idaho is clear. Shelby, you've done work on salmon issues in other places, and this has to have come into play. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. Let's see. I've volunteered for a couple salmon nonprofits over in Washington State, and yeah, the implications. For example, I spent a whole summer on the Skagit River national or scenic river system with my AmeriCorps crew, going down these waterways and finding invasive plant species along the way, and helping to restore riparian zones along that river system. But yeah, I mean, this act allowed us to go down these rivers and enjoy not only the natural resources along the way, but also the like free flowing water, and able to see the connection between our work as we're restoring these river habitats, and also being able to connect on a larger level in terms of like community members or like on a team, and really establish, I guess I'm losing my words, but being able to bond on these waterways, like as a team and in nature, and having that connection to nature, and this act allowed us to do that.
And so when we think of streams and fish, salmon in the Northwest are iconic, but Julie, yeah, there's other fish that benefit from this. And I know you're a fisher person, so tell us about that.
Well, sure, absolutely. I mean, the salmon and the trout benefit, but we also have that great big iconic fish in the Kootenai. we all know what it's, the beautiful, great big,
the sturgeon.
Sturgeon, yeah. Thank you. And so those guys are benefiting. And
yeah, and you have to put ourselves back in time. In 1968, we were losing the bald eagle, the American symbol, our icon. And it was part of the impetus for the Endangered Species Act and the banning of DDT.
Yes.
But the congregation of eagles along the Skagit River because of the salmon run have been estimated to be in the thousands. And without that food source to draw them in together and do what they do to produce more eagles, you know, it's part of the recovery.
And as we know from having Wayne Melquist talk on our show, the osprey have benefited mm-hmm. as well. They are the most robust population of osprey in the whole country here.
Mm-hmm. So I want to turn this a little bit from things that sound almost like they're textbook stuff to the personal impacts that the National Wild Scenic River have had on lives. And I think everybody here has a story, but I want to hear Deb's story a little bit from the perspective of a river's user.
Well, I was thinking about this yesterday, and I don't believe that any of the rivers I've paddled are officially designated as wild and scenic, but certainly the Yukon was a very wild place, was a very scenic place. I believe some of the tributaries to the Yukon were designated. The 40 Mile River is one that comes to mind. And not only from a recreation standpoint of using the water for transportation, but water quality issues are important. And I'm sure in our hiking lives, we've relied on a wild and scenic river for our water supply to get water. So it's not just about having a whitewater experience, something to paddle and get crazy about, but it's also the having clean water to drink and rely on.
They're places that inspire people, too. Brad, I know you like rivers, so tell us a little bit about your personal connection to rivers.
Yeah, you know, I think Idaho's rivers are some of the most beautiful rivers around. I've done float trips on the Middle Fork and the Maine Salmon that were just really incredible experiences, very transformative, that led to an appreciation of rivers and their free-flowing condition that I probably wouldn't have today. And many people flock to Idaho for its whitewater experiences. You know, my coworker, John Robison in Boise, moved here from North Carolina because he came to float the North Fork of the Payette River. It was, you know, world-renowned whitewater experience. So we're really blessed here in Idaho. And, you know, I think the other reason Idahoans enjoy our free-flowing rivers is, again, for the salmon, the steelhead, and the trout fisheries that we have. You know, it's pretty amazing when you go down to the Clearwater Basin, you'll see people standing in the South Fork of the Clearwater River in February and March when it's, you know, below freezing, and they're out there catching these big B-run steelhead, and probably nobody would be out there otherwise that time mm-hmm. of year.
And it's a place to take your children. I don't want to give too much away, but you just came back from a three-day trip on the Kootenai River, didn't you not?
Yeah, we floated the Kootenai River in our canoe from the confluence with the Yak down to the confluence with the Moye. Not a wild and scenic river, but that section of the river is free-flowing, and it was a very, very great experience. You know, we got to camp out on an island in the middle of the river and fish for some rainbow trout. Very, very great experience.
It is, and yeah. I've been on that stretch of the Kootenai, too. And what's so amazing is that you really see almost no development, do you? It's just like without houses. It's a gorgeous area on the Kootenai.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. My own personal trajectory, if I did not have the experience on the Allegash River at age 10, one of the first of the wild and scenic rivers, I would not have become as interested in either the adventure of rivers and backpacking or the work it needs to take to preserve those places. And so for me, the impetus that these places give has broad impacts on a lot of other areas. So the Kootenai may not be a wild and scenic river, but getting inspired by the wild and scenic river can lead people to do things to preserve its free flow.
Absolutely.
And it's so interesting because you know, years and years ago, in the time when dams were happening, we all thought that was the right thing to do. But there's been so much education and so much change, and I'm so happy to see it and talk about it on this anniversary. And Shelby, you were about to say something, so go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say that I didn't really realize the value of these wild and scenic rivers, or just rivers in general, and having access to them across the country until leaving for the Peace Corps and being a volunteer for the last couple of years and not really having access to the natural resources or the trails in my backyard over the course of that time, and to be able to come back to Idaho and reopen that door back into nature, it's been pretty spectacular, and what a place to begin exploring again.
So I want to bring this back to the present time and how this act is still important to us in our daily lives today as we go out and experience these things. But what does the future hold, Brad? How does this inform the work that Idaho Conservation League does?
Yeah, so here in Idaho, we have actually about 892 miles of designated wild and scenic rivers. That's actually only a fraction of the rivers and streams that we have here in Idaho. There's potential for more. And the way that this typically works is that the Forest Service, or the BLM, which manages a lot of the public lands and rivers in the United States, when they revamp their management plans for each of the national forests or BLM field offices, they go through a process to evaluate rivers and streams to see if they have the potential to be added to the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act. And one of the national forests that is looking at their plan right now is the Nez Perce Clearwater National Forest in north central Idaho. And this is some of the most spectacular river country in the state. You have rivers like the North Fork of the Clearwater, the South Fork of the Clearwater, that aren't designated as wild and scenic, but would make great additions to the wild and scenic rivers system, in my opinion. And if you reflect back on the purpose of the act, preserving these rivers in a free-flowing condition would ensure that future generations can enjoy them the way that we do today. There are actually 11 potential dam sites on the South Fork of the Clearwater River and 23 on the North Fork. And if we designated those rivers as wild and scenic, then we could be sure that they would remain free-flowing into the future. Some may debate whether or not, you know, there's actually a threat of dams being built on those rivers, because we are no longer in an era of dam building in this country. But, you know, I don't think that that's necessarily off the table as we think about climate change and the potential impacts on water and water use. I think there's certainly the opportunity for proponents of dams to come forward with those proposals. And in fact, we have a proposal for a dam on the Weezer River in southern Idaho.
Yeah, and I want to suggest, too, that when you look at the really big picture of what the Act has done and how it's intended to be used, it was intended to be one that had a vision for which places to set aside, and it accommodated the idea that dams should still be built. And to date, the vast number of rivers and miles have been protected are still less than 1% of the navigable rivers in the U.S. So it is only a very small slice of the pie we're talking about, but it's the important slice.
That's absolutely right.
I think, too, if, you know, before we can talk all day about rivers, we want to get to trails, but before we do, I want to leave with an idea that we've been talking about recreational impacts from the standpoint of getting out and paddling or hiking, but the Locksaw River is a perfect example of how protecting that as wild and scenic also enhances tourism and those who grew up in Idaho via the Locksaw River Highway. And Brad, I think you've been close to some of the issues surrounding that, so talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, the Locksaw River, you know, it's a very magnificent river, definitely one of Idaho's most iconic. If you go to the Locksaw River during runoff, you will see lots of whitewater enthusiasts floating the Locksaw River. I personally have not done it. It's very technical, but I know a lot of people enjoy that, and they probably wouldn't be enjoying that today had we not passed the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act, because there was a proposal for a major dam at Penny Cliffs on the Middle Fork of the Clearwater River that actually would have flooded not only the Middle Fork of the Clearwater, but also the Locksaw and the Selway. Mm-hmm. And we wouldn't have those magnificent resources today without the act.
And we wouldn't be able to drive that wonderful, one would almost call it a wilderness highway drive that many people could enjoy without ever getting outside of their car. They can pull up to the pullout, look over, breathe in, and what a fabulous experience that is.
That's right. Highway 12, which parallels the Locksaw River, connects Lewiston, Idaho with Missoula, Montana, one of the most scenic drives in Idaho.
So before we take a song break and turn to trails, any last-minute thoughts, things to share about wild and scenic rivers and their impact on our lives?
Well, I think it's just, you know, again, a really momentous occasion, the 50th anniversary of the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act. You know, I am certainly one of the beneficiaries of this act because I enjoy free-flowing rivers. Many other Idahoans and Americans are beneficiaries of this act, and I think it's a great cause to celebrate today.
Mm-hmm. Right, and many species have been benefited by this act, and mm-hmm. I'm very thankful that it happened.
Mm-hmm. And I want to say, in leading up to this show, I've been sharing some of my personal experiences with friends and through other means, and I think the impact that it has on our lives, the bonding experience that it is for families, I know that deepened my relationship with the outside world, with my dad, with friends, and some of the most deep bonding experience I've had, some of the closest relationships I have today were formed on rivers.
Me too.
All right, well, we're all in agreement there. So we're going to take a song break. Whitewater, Shauna Lang. If you weren't awake before, you are now.
And that did come to an abrupt end.
It does.
Good thing we were watching for it.
Yeah. But that's the way a lot of rapids are.
So true.
We're back now. We're going to shift and we're going to talk about trails. The National Trails Act was also signed October 2nd, 1968. It fundamentally did three things. It set up a system of national scenic trails, national historic trails, and national recreation trails. And most people probably know more or have heard more about the iconic national scenic trails. And we're going to spend a little bit of time on each of those. But really important and near and dear to my heart as a long-distance hiker is it formally established the Pacific Crest Trail and the Appalachian Trail as the two first recognized trails in that system. It also authorized directly a study of the Continental Divide Trail that was completed about 8 years later and suggested studies for another 13 trails, to which today there are a total of 11 trails in the system. And I need to look up the miles, but it's a phenomenal amount. I would say more than one person could walk in a lifetime, but I actually know at least one person who has walked them all in their lifetime.
Who is it, Deb? No.
It's not a quite. Crazy, zany hiker friend of ours. So I think a really good place to start here, we were talking on the break, is how do these other trails come into existence? You know, how did the mechanics happen? And the first is that it authorizes a study, and a lot of people get together and spend a lot of time writing long and lengthy reports, and those are dry and dusty and would just fall in the dust bin of an administrator unless people come together. And Brad, you do some of this work in the form of ICL and some as an individual advocate. So take us from there. How do these trails then come about?
These trails come about, again, through an act of Congress. Phil mentioned the study process where, you know, some of the agencies come forward and are asked to evaluate, you know, potential additions to the National Scenic Trails system. One of those was the Pacific Northwest Trail, which goes from Glacier National Park through Idaho and Northern Washington to the Olympic Peninsula. And this was added to the National Scenic Trail System in 2009. It was actually originally studied as an addition to the system back in the 80s. And believe it or not, the study report that was produced by federal agencies recommended that Congress actually not designate the trail. But Congress can do whatever it wants. And in 2009, they added this trail to the mm-hmm. system.
Well, all right.
And that was an interesting process. Lots of bills today happen this way. They don't pass individually. They come together in a package. This particular trail was a package called the Lands Omnibus Bill. It had 154 different pieces of legislation, including a number of wilderness areas and a number of trails. There were three National Scenic Trails authorized on that day, the Pacific Northwest, the New England Trail, and the Arizona Trail. And each had their own history, and in many ways, each were somewhat established on the ground, but not complete. And the legislation provided some official status for them, so they had an official management process and the impetus to go out and complete the miles that will take some time. They don't happen overnight. Again, historically, we look at the best known of the trails, probably the Appalachian Trail. It took 50 years to completely build out.
And the Pacific Northwest Trail is not complete at this time, as you mentioned, and it still has some patches where you've got to kind of figure it out, correct?
Yeah, and actually one of these patches is in the Selkirk Mountains, just north of here. That patch or stretch of the trail, you know, basically what happens is there's about 50 thru-hikers a year that are using the Pacific Northwest Trail at the moment, or at this current time, and they just have to kind of bushwhack over the Selkirk Crest to get to the other side. But eventually, the goal is to get the trail on a prism for its entire length so that you're not bushwhacking or road walking. There's actually hundreds of miles of road walking that you currently have to do through portions of the three states that it passes through. So the ultimate goal is to get it on trail tread for the entire length.
And this process also takes citizen involvement, input, and support. And Brad, you're involved in that. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so when these trails are designated, Congress also authorizes the creation of these advisory committees to aid the management agencies in the planning process for these trails. You know, each trail has, this is kind of dry stuff, but each trail has a management plan that sets out the goals, the uses of the trail, and things like that. And the advisory committee that was created for the Pacific Northwest Trail was authorized by Congress, and I was nominated and approved to be on that committee as a wildlife representative. And there are also representatives from the thru-hiking community, from tribes, from local government, and various other interests. And we all work with the Forest Service to draft the management plan for the Pacific Northwest Trail.
Mm-hmm. And the purpose of the wildlife consultation is what? To just minimize impact for those guys, for the wildlife?
Yeah, so when these trails are added to the system, the other part of the process is to make sure that where the trail is located doesn't impact or conflict with other resource needs. And in our area, we have a grizzly bear population that is listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act. And we got some work there to find a route that minimizes conflicts between humans and grizzly bears.
Mm-hmm. So I want to turn for a moment to personal experiences around trails. And we can come back and talk policy too, especially about the other units of the system. But these have important impacts on our lives. And, you know, I'll start with something that may not be intuitive, but Deb and I do a lot of thru-hiking. So we have a cadre of friends who are also hikeaholics and nothing better to do than quit their job for months at a time and walk long distances. And we only get to see them every so often. But now with the Pacific Northwest Trail coming through close to town, we get to see more of them more often. And that's a fun thing for me. But Deb, I want you to talk a little bit about how long trails have impacted your life.
Well, Phil and I never would have met if not for the Pacific Crest Trail.
That's a huge impact.
Pretty big.
Through hiking the trail solo, and I heard about his hike through a friend and was really intrigued and curious about what it would be like to spend 5 or 6 months out hiking. So I went out and joined him for a few days, and the rest is history, as they say.
I thought you'd say the rest is a romance novel, but...
Well, we immediately made plans to hike the Appalachian Trail, and so that was my first long hike, and it's really a life-changing experience to be out for 5 or 6 months in the outdoors, hiking, seeing the land from that perspective.
And the relationships you build. The Appalachian Trail, for those who aren't familiar, starts in Georgia, depending on which direction you're going, and ends in Maine a couple thousand miles later, and traverses through 13 states in the East Coast, and within a two-hour drive of about 75% of the U.S. population. So it's used not only by long-distance hikers, but a daily cadre of individual day hikers or weekend hikers.
And it's deceptively difficult. People think, oh, back east, they just have little hills. There's no big mountains. But I think that trail was built before switchbacks were invented.
Oh, boy.
So you just tend to go up and down mountains with rocks and tree roots. And it's actually a very physically demanding hike.
Of the differences, each trail has its own sense of character and its own management plan. And the East Coast trails weren't built by or for stock animals. So the number of switchbacks and the quality of the foot tread are different than our Western trails. And as Deb suggested, it defies what a lot of people think in their popular imagination.
Yeah, and it's also an amazing wildlife corridor. We wouldn't have it if not for that trail.
It is, and I want to give a shout out to a couple people instrumental before 1968. We wouldn't have had the Appalachian Trail. We wouldn't have the architecture for the Wilderness Act or the Trails Act without Benton McKay, founder of the Wilderness Society, father of the Appalachian Trail. And what he envisioned was this corridor running the East Coast up the spine of the Appalachian Trails that had a network of trails, the main one and branch trails, and it does today. It had connector trails to towns so that people could access it, and it would preserve this large area, this wide corridor of land for wildlife movement. It was very visionary.
Really true.
Yeah. Brad, I know you've had some personal experience with some long trails. Tell us about them.
Yeah, in 2015, my wife Sarah and I hiked the John Muir Trail in the Sierra Nevadas, and that's a 220-mile trail from Yosemite National Park to the top of Mount Whitney, which is the tallest peak in the lower 48. We spent 13 days hiking that trail, and it mostly aligns with the Pacific Northwest Trail for most of its length. Where it differs is where it starts in Yosemite Valley and where it ends on Mount Whitney. But, you know, the High Sierras are truly one of the country's most iconic mountain ranges, the Range of Light, as it was known by John Muir. And it's a pretty incredible experience, and I highly encourage anybody who loves the outdoors to consider at some point in their life taking a long distance hike, because you will come away with a greater appreciation for nature and for wild places.
And as long distance hike goes, that might be a good starter hike for those of us thinking about doing more, because I have not done a long one. That sounds like it might be my starter.
The John Muir Trail is built at a very nice grade. It is mostly built to a standard that allows stock use, so it's a low grade, unlike the Appalachian Trail. However, you are at high altitude, so you know you end on Mount Whitney, which is again the tallest peak in the lower 48 at over 14,500 and something plus feet, and so you do have to be prepared for altitude and for sucking a little wind.
So, Julie, you've sent your husband, Daniel, out on the PCT a couple times. You could put him on that section and have him report back.
That's right, as a starter. And this, I think, is often the case for people wanting to accomplish a long-distance hike. They start and they don't always finish. But he's not done trying, so I think he'll be out again.
Yeah, that's a good point. People don't have to hike the trails all the way through. Benton McKay never envisioned anyone going end-to-end, but you know, using the parts of it that were most pertinent to their daily lives. Shelby, tell us a little bit about how the trails interact with your daily life or your monthly or weekly life.
Yeah. Well, while I don't have much experience on these longer trails, my childhood was full of exploring national recreational trails. And that time out in the wilderness really just set the trajectory for my personal life in terms of going up to Western Washington and majoring in environmental science and doing more environmental work.
So that's a great segue to the National Scenic Trails are the iconic ones that hit the spreads on National Geographic and radio shows like ours. But the system that was created, the National Trails System, as envisioned by the Trails Act, set aside, established these three different categories. And so to clarify a little bit here, the scenic trails are tending to be a little over 100 miles in length, have outstanding recreation and conservation values, and they're preserving iconic landscapes. The National Recreation Trail System is much larger. Not only does it have way more than 11, it has 1,000 trails in it. And it was really designed to provide high-quality experiences for the day or for the weekend near major urban centers. So they didn't have to be 100 miles. They could be, but they didn't have to be. And they really provided that access so that anyone had some availability to these experiences. And that system's grown. We have a local trail that at one time was in that system that I think is worthy of talking about a little bit.
Yeah, so Phil is hinting at the B-Top Round Top Trail above Clark Fork and Hope, which was a local national recreation trail. And these are much more easily added to the system. It doesn't require an act of Congress. A Forest Service administrator can sign a document and add those to the system, and then they get kind of a special status. But the B-Top Round Top Trail is one of our underappreciated resources in this area because it offers pretty tremendous views of Lake Ponderay and the Cabinet Mountains and the Selkirk Mountains. I think it's underutilized because of the fact that you practically just couldn't get to one end of it until a couple of years ago. There was historically access at the east end near Clark Fork, but a private land owner blocked access several decades ago, and there has not been access until recently on that end when the Forest Service completed a land exchange to establish a new trailhead at the east end. So I suspect we will see more use of this trail. Yeah.
And it may return to national recreation status. The act also established a process called rail banking, which is an unfamiliar term to most, but what it means, it allowed for the conversion of unused old railroad beds to trails. And that's a process that's occurred throughout the country. And there's some going on here locally, the hoped for linkage of Sand Point to Points West, Priest River, and the border go along old railroad bed routes. And what a fabulous tool.
Yes, and the one that's being talked about locally, of course, is the Ponderay Passage Trail, which would connect Sand Point and Priest River. That would be a tremendous opportunity for people to hike or walk or cycle between the two towns.
Devin, I think you grew up doing some national recreation trails in your neighborhood with your brother.
Yeah, well, we lived in Pennsylvania, so we were close to the Appalachian Trail. And those were some of my very first hiking experiences. I didn't grow up doing a lot with my parents. And my brother kind of got me interested, gave me a lot of hand-me-down tents and backpacks. And we would go out mostly just for a weekend. But that formed the basis for my interest and love of hiking. Mm-hmm.
And generally, most of our trails and scenic rivers in the western U.S.? I mean, just to give me an idea of where I might find them all.
Yeah, that's a great question. And so if you look at a map of the Wild and Scenic River system, it includes 40 states as well as the District of Columbia and Puerto Rico. So not every state. There's a large amount that are in the west, but there's also a pretty good concentration of the northeast.
Good. And then just another comment about these trail rivers and the trails. And when I think about it, I think, well, it's such a wonderful resource or gem for us in the U.S., but we're not the only ones who appreciate it. People come from all over the world to use these trails and riverways. I think we're a bit unique, don't you?
In some ways, we are, yes, at least in terms of the iconic landscape. Walking is a very established tradition in much of Europe, and they have a fabulous network of trails, but they're not the trails you're going to camp along. You're going to stay in a hostel or a bed and breakfast or a farmhouse, where most of the trails that we've been talking about, you're going to camp out under the stars. That's the thing that draws people in from all over the world.
I think so. Very wild areas.
Before we run out of time, we should talk a little bit about the historic National Historic Trails. They were designed, as it might imply, to preserve historic travel routes, and they capture some of the popular imagination. And a few of those go through Idaho. There's 19 in total, and they do everything from capturing the route that Lewis and Clark went along. So these are trails that in some places are hard to replicate a recreational experience. Some have tried, some have succeeded, but there are also places where we can go and visit spots along the way, interpretive centers. They include places that Lewis and Clark might have stopped. But the Nez Perce Trail of Tears is one that a few local authors have written about and have moved many. And both of those cross Idaho, as well as the Mormon and Pioneer Trails. And you know, Brad, I don't know if there's anything specific you want to reflect on that, but I see you nodding your head, so...
Yeah, the Nez Perce National Historic Trail is one of my favorite as far as historic trails go. That is a trail that crosses the Bitterroot Mountains from Idaho to Montana, and that is the route essentially that Lewis and Clark took when they crossed Idaho. And the Nez Perce used this trail, again, to go from the Clearwater Basin over to the Bitterroot Valley, and they would send hunting parties over to hunt buffalo in Montana, in present-day Montana. And they would bring back buffalo and meat and hides to their camps in Idaho. And again, as I mentioned, Lewis and Clark took that route over the Bitterroots. Very wild country.
Mm-hmm. And I'll say in our experiences, sometimes the scenic trails overlap with these. And there's a good chunk of the Continental Divide Trail in Wyoming that follows the Oregon Trail. And you can still see today the depth of the wagon ruts from the early pioneers in the 1840s on the Oregon Trail in Wyoming. So these trails give us a lot of different opportunities to recreate, to conserve the landscape. They've provided places for our imagination to roam. We have the tools to add more. The work's not done. We're going to close out soon, but let's go with a vision for the future and how these pieces come together, Brad.
It's a very aspirational request. You know, I think that just in a time of increasing technology and mechanization and increasing population, it's really easy for our country, our society, and our race to lose sight of kind of our roots and some of the things that really make life great, like nature and the outdoors. And for the future, you know, we need to think about ways to get kids away from devices and back out in nature, because if you haven't experienced these things, then you won't care about them.
I agree.
Mm-hmm. So we didn't get around much to talking about the North Cascades National Park, the Satan Wilderness Area, the Glacier Peak Wilderness Area. We're running a bit low on time, but Shelby, your work on salmon, your work over in the Seattle area, those were hugely impactful, weren't they?
Yeah, for sure. Having that experience on the rivers, on the ocean, in the forest, truly, like I said before, set the trajectory for my passions and interests, and I would not be the person I am today without those experiences.
Mm-hmm. And the last thing President Johnson did was the Redwoods National Park. Deb, your time in California, Redwoods.
Just amazing. It's kind of funny to come out here and we have these huge, huge cedar trees. But when I first moved to California, I know that was a huge draw. And the Muir Woods, if you try to go there on a weekend, it's one of the big, huge redwood groves. You can't park anywhere near it. It's such a draw for people to come in and see these huge trees.
Mm-hmm. They are truly amazing. And it's true for Julie, you're having come from Minnesota, and we've got big trees there too, but it's just nothing like the redwoods. And it's so lucky that we preserve those, because there's nothing else like it, is there?
Yes, it's so inspiring. It's so inspiring. And that was a good start in 68. The area was doubled in size 10 years later by President Carter, and it continues to be added on to this day. There was a provision in the 2009 Lands Omnibus Bill that made additions to that. So the work goes on. There's a lot more to do with it. But I think if we get out there and play today, if everyone listening goes out and spends at least a moment outside in the rain, or maybe in the sun when it clears, or maybe hold this thought for tomorrow, But go out and enjoy, because that's the only way we'll really truly appreciate the landscapes and come to do more for them.
Right, and continue thinking about places that need to be saved, that need to be preserved, that haven't been preserved yet.
Okay. Well, we're going to end the show on that note and take in a little bit of Walking Jim Stoltz, one of the great troubadours of long-distance hiking.